About 30 good horses were tethered outside. Country people were already crowding in, bringing grain, grass, butter, meat, and so forth. This was the place where the official had actually put up. A stalwart head servant supervised the entrance of the things brought by the villagers. He stopped Yongnan, and after a talk which appeared to me endless, he ordered a man to give us a meal of tea and sampa. We could not refuse this kind offer. Beggars like us could but rejoice at this piece of good luck. We made a pretense of it, seated on the steps of the kitchen, smiling, laughing, and joking with the attendants of the gentleman, but all the while we felt rather inclined to take to our heels. The thing which proved most tiresome, and even at times became excessively difficult in the life I was now leading, was the part that I was always obliged to play in order to preserve my incognito, in a country where everything is done in public, down to the most intimate personal acts. I was forced to affect peculiar local customs which embarrassed me terribly. Happily, our way lay at times through large tracts of uninhabited land, and the greater freedom which I enjoyed there somewhat relieved my painful nervous tension. There, especially, I was able to avoid the indescribable soups which the kindly but poverty-stricken fellows, our hosts, bestowed upon us, and which we had to swallow down with a smile, for fear of suspicious comments. Once only did I depart from my accustomed attitude of the beggar to whom everything tastes good, but that day. We have arrived toward nightfall in a little village. It was very cold and the stark surroundings afforded no shelter. We had already been refused hospitality at several houses, when a woman opened her door to us, at the rickety door of an exceedingly miserable dwelling. We entered, a fire burned on the hearth, and in this frosty weather this in itself afforded comfort. The husband of the woman came back shortly afterwards, bringing out some handfuls of tsampa from the bottom of a beggar's wallet, and we realized that no supper could be expected from people who had nothing to eat themselves. After a few words of praise for the generosity of an imaginary chief who has given Hini a rupee, Yongdan declares that he will buy some meat, if there is any to be had in the village. "Ti know of a good place," said a host at once, scenting a windfall. From the corner where I was crouching, I insisted that it should be of good quality. Most Tibetans eat without any repugnance the putrefied flesh of animals which have died of disease. Not bring back the flesh of an animal which has died, nor a piece which has decayed, I said. "No, no," said the man. "I know what I am about. You shall have something good." About 10 minutes passed. The village is not large, and the peasant soon returned. "There," he said, triumphantly, drawing a large parcel of some kind from beneath his sheepskin robe. "What can this be? The room is lighted only by the embers of the fire, and I cannot clearly distinguish anything." The man seems to be opening something, probably a cloth which he has wrapped round his purchase. Ugh! A most fearsome odor suddenly fills the room, the smell of a charnel house. It is sickening. "Oh," says Yongdan, in a voice that trembles slightly, concealing the nausea that he is obliged to repress. "Oh, it is a stomach, I understand now. The Tibetans, when they kill a beast, have a horrible habit of enclosing in the stomach, the kidneys, heart, liver, and entrails of the animal. They then sew up this kind of bag, and its contents go on decaying inside for days, weeks, and even longer." "Yes, it is a stomach," repeats its purchaser, whose voice also trembles somewhat, but with joy, seeing the mass of food is stuffed falling out of the now opened bag. "It is full," he exclaims, "quite full. Oh, what a lot." He has placed the horror on the floor, is plunging his bands into it, taking out the gelatinous entrails. Three children who were asleep on a heap of tatters have awakened, and are now squatting in front of their father, watching him eagerly with covetous eyes. "Yes, yes, a stomach," repeats Yongdan, in consternation. "Here, mother, here is a saucepan," says the woman, kindly, addressing me, "you can prepare your supper." "What, am I to handle this filth?" I whisper hastily to my son, "tell them that I am ill." It always seems your turn to be 111 when something unpleasant befalls us, Yongdan growls, under his breath. But the boy is resourceful, he has already regained his self-possession. The old mother is ill, he announces. Why do you not make the tupa, thick soup, yourselves? I want everybody to have a share. The two peasants do not wait to be invited a second time, and the youngsters, realizing that a feast is in course of preparation, stay quietly by the fire, having no desire to go to sleep again. The mother takes up a chopper and a rustic chopping block made out of a log, on which she cuts the carrion into small pieces. From time to time one of these drops upon the floor, and then the children fall upon it like young puppies and devour it raw. Now this fowl soup is boiling, and a little barley meal is added. Finally the supper is ready. Take some, mother, it will do you good, say the husband and wife. I confine myself to groaning, in the corner where I have stretched myself. Let her sleep, says Yongdan. He cannot himself be excused. Ajapas who spend a rupee on meat and do not touch it do not exist. Tomorrow the whole village would be talking about it. He has to swallow down a full bowl of the evil-smelling liquid, but beyond that he cannot go, and he declares that he, too, is not feeling very well. I do not wonder at it. The others feast long and gluttonously upon the broth, smacking their lips in silence, overcome with joy at this unexpected bonbouche, and I am overtaken by sleep whilst the family is still masticating noisily. We travelled across more hills and more valleys, we passed by more gompas, we sat with more peasants, and met two ponpos on the road, one of whom bestowed on us most useful presents of food. Thus we progressed in the direction of the Sipo Kangla. At the foot of the pass one of those mysterious and inexplicable incidents was to befall us, such as sometimes bewilder the traveller in Tibet. A long tramp had brought us to a gorge in which a clear stream flowed toward the invisible Sailween, which we were again approaching for the last time. It was scarcely nor aught, and we felt reluctant to waste a whole afternoon in a village house when we could still have gone on for several hours. We had been informed that it was impossible to cross the range in one day, even if we started before dawn, so that we were bound in any case to spend the night on the hills. We therefore thought it wiser to continue on our way, and if the cold prevented us from camping, we could walk on through the night, as we had often done. But before starting on this long tramp I wished to eat a good meal. Water was now at our feet, and we could not guess when we should again run across a stream. Yongdan gladly agreed to make a halt, and as soon as we had reached the bank we put our loads on the shingle, and my companion began to light a fire with the few twigs that I had gathered under some trees which grew at the end of the fields. A little boy whom I had noticed on the other side of the river then crossed the bridge and ran toward Yongdan. He bowed down three times before him as Tibetans do in their greetings to great lamas. We were most astonished. What could have made that child give such a deep token of reverence to a mere beggar pilgrim? Without giving us time to put any question, the boy addressed Yongdan. My grandfather, who is very ill, he said, has told us all, this morning, that a lama coming down that hill, was to make tea in the dry part of the riverbed and that he wanted to see him. Since the sun has risen my brother and I have watched in turn at the bridge to invite the lama to our house. Now that you have come, please follow me. Titi is not my son whom your grandfather expects, I told the boy. We are people from a far off country. He does not know us, he said. The lama who would make tea on the stones, who insisted the child, and as we did not comply with his request he crossed the river again and disappeared between the fences of the fields. We had just begun to drink our tea when the boy reappeared, accompanied by a young trooper. Lama, the latter said to Yongdan, be kind enough to come to see my father. He is very ill and says that he is about to die. He only waits for a lama who will arrive today and who is the one and only person who can direct him to a happy place of rebirth in the next world. He told us all this morning that you would come down that hill and make tea, here on the stones, near the river. All has happened as he said. Now please be kind to us and come. Neither Yongdan nor I knew what to think about Thaya queer affair. We persisted in believing that the sufferer meant some lama whom he knew and had some reason to expect on this road. Nevertheless, seeing the trooper weeping, I advised my companion to pay a visit to the sick villager. So he promised to go as soon as we had finished our meal. The boy and the young trooper, Ahizund, I understood, went to report our answer to the farmer. But presently I saw another boy seated near the bridge observing us. These people were certainly afraid that Yongdan would fail to keep his promise, and therefore kept him in sight. No escape was possible, and why indeed should Yongdan have disappointed an old invalid? The latter would evidently see that my son was not the one he expected, and all would end with no more than 10 minutes' delay. All the family had assembled at the door of the farm. They greeted Yongdan with the greatest respect. My companion was then led into the room, and while he went toward the cushions on which the farmer lay, I remained near the threshold with the women of the house. The old man did not really appear as one who is near death. His voice was firm and his intelligent eyes showed that his mental faculties were in no way dimmed. He wished to rise and bow down to my son, but the latter prevented him from moving out of his blankets, saying that sick people need only mean the respectful salute. "Lama," the farmer said, "I have been longing for your coming, but I knew that you were to come and I waited for you, to die. You are my Drut Sorwai Lama, and no one but you alone can lead me to the land of bliss. Have compassion on me, bless me, do not refuse me your help." What the old man wished was for Yongdan to utter for his benefit the mystic words called power, which are pronounced at the deathbed of a lay lamaist or of any monk who is not an initiate, when the latter is quite beyond all hope of recovery. As I have said, the old Tibetan did not seem to be near to death, and for religious reasons whose explanations would be out of place here, my companion hesitated to yield to his wishes. He tried in vain to hearten the sick man, assuring him that he would not die, and offering to recite the spells which mend life and give it new strength. This the farmer, however, obstinately refused, maintaining that he knew his hour to be at hand and had only awaited the spiritual aid of his lama to take his departure. He then began to weep and order those present to entreat the lama on his behalf. The family did so, sobbing and weeping, with repeated prostrations, until, overpowered, Yongdan finally gave in. Then, deep moved, he recited the ritual words which loosen the ties of the dead, and lead them safely through the labyrinthine paths of the other worlds. When we left him, the old farmer's face expressed a perfect serenity, a complete detachment from all earthly concerns, having, it seemed, entered the true blissful paradise which, being nowhere and everywhere, lies in the mind of each one of us. I shall not venture to offer any explanation of this peculiar incident. I have related the fact thinking that it might interest those who pursue psychic researches, but I would feel exceedingly sorry if my account provoked commentaries disrespectful to the memory of the departed Tibetan. Death and the dying are never to be made a subject of raillery. Last word means kidding. Those who had told us that the road across the Sipokang Hills was a long one, were certainly right. We walked on from the dawn, meeting nobody and mistaking our way on several occasions at the intersection of trails leading to Dokpa's summer camps. At dusk we were still far from the pass. A blizzard then rose, as we climbed a steep and waterless slope. There was no camping place in the vicinity, and we had almost decided to retrace our steps and shelter ourselves much lower down at a place where we had seen some empty huts, when we heard the tinkling of horses' bells and three men appeared on the way up like ourselves. They were traders, and told us that a little farther along on the road there was a farm wherein we could get shelter. It was pitch dark when we arrived. I understood from the large stables that the place was a kind of inn for the use of travelers crossing the pass at a season when camping in the open is rather dangerous. We were admitted to the kitchen with the merchants who fed us with soup, tea, sampa and dried fruits. These men belonged to a village in the same neighborhood as the sick farmer. Passing there in the morning, they had heard all about Yongdan, and brought us the sad news that at dawn, when we ourselves had left the village, the old man had smiled and died. E-traders had been deeply impressed by the account of their friend's last hours. The thoughts of all being turned toward religion, they begged Yongdan to preach them a sermon, which he did. The kitchen, the only living room of the farm, was very small, and with the blazing fire that burned quite near us, we were half roasted. Then, when the time came to sleep, we understood that the owner and his wife wished to remain alone. The traders went down the ladder to the stable, where they slept near their beasts. As for us, we were told to accommodate ourselves on the flat roof. What a change from that oven-like kitchen to the cold air of a frosty night, with a blizzard raging, at 15,000 or 16,000 feet above sea level. It was not the first time that I had experienced this kind of hospitality. More than once villagers had invited us, treated us to a good supper, and then sent us on the roof or into the courtyard. Nobody apparently thought much of it in Tibet, but that night I lacked the courage to lie down in the open air, and I begged permission, which was granted, to sleep next the kitchen in a shelter shut in on three sides. The next day we crossed the pass and descended to the Sipa Monastery, beautifully situated in a lonely spot with an extended view in front of it. The traders were on horseback, and had reached the Gompa long before us. They had stayed there for a while and had told the lamas about Yongdan, so that when he arrived, meaning to purchase some food, he was cordially welcomed and invited to remain a few days to discuss matters concerning the Buddhist doctrine with some of the monastery's learned inmates. As for myself, I could also get lodging in a guest house. But as I had not accompanied my adopted son to the monastery, and had continued my way, I was already out of sight amongst the hills, so Yongdan declined the kind invitation. I regretted it afterwards, but as Nirol of a laywoman would very likely have kept me away from the place where the literati of the monastery would hold their meetings with Yongdan, I consoled myself with no great difficulty. A little later in the evening, we met a woman going to the Gompa who told us that we could find a shelter in a partly ruined house that was easily seen from the road. The country was once more a complete desert, and we could not help to reach the lower valley on the same day. It proved more and more true that the crossing of the Sipo Kangla was a long one. We walked about an hour longer without discovering the house, but at last reached it when it was nearly dark. It had been a really large and well-built farm with a good number of stables, sheds, storerooms, servants' quarters, and a pretty apartment upstairs for the owners. Everything was now in a dilapidated condition, but with a little work it would have been quite possible to make the necessary repairs, for no essential parts of the building were ruined. We had nearly finished our meal when the woman who had told us about that house arrived with a young boy, her son. She was the owner of the farm and had left it, though there were good fields around it, after a terrible drama. A few years before, a gang of robbers from the Po country had attacked this isolated farm and there had been a terrific struggle. Four of the masters, the woman's husband, her two brothers, another relative, and a few servants had been killed, while others were wounded. The robbers also had left several dead on the ground. Since then the unhappy housewife and her family lived in the village near the monastery. The fear that a similar outrage would happen again, naturally kept her away from her farm, which gradually fell into ruins. But another and still stronger fear prevented her from returning to her former house. The farm was believed to be haunted by evil spirits. The violent death of so many men had attracted them, and, with the ghosts of the murderers and their victims, they roamed about the buildings. For this reason the woman had come back from the Gompa to ask the Lama to spend the night in her house, to exorcise it. She could have requested the services of the Lamas of Sipo, and most likely some of them had already performed the required rites on her behalf, but, as I have already mentioned, Red Cap Lamas are deemed more powerful exorcists than their colleagues of the Yellow Sect. Moreover, Yongdan, for obvious reasons, had a real success as a lama holder of the secret spells. Had he established himself somewhere, clients would have flocked to his residence. But he hated that kind of trade, he had seen it from too near. Nevertheless, kindness compelled him to comply with the wishes of the woman. He told her that if she wished to cultivate her property again, she could do so without fear of any denizen of another world, but that serious precautions were to be taken against robbers. The following day we arrived in the Dacian province, and here again, as along the Salween, I was the guest of many. I never regretted my roundabout tour in that country. It is out of the way of the great trade routes, and absolutely unknown to foreigners. Yet it is a well-cultivated area. Large and prosperous monasteries are seen in several places, the villages seem to be well built, and the people are agreeable. I saw some interesting soda fields from which Tibetans get the stuff they mix with their tea when boiling it. Once we passed a rich traveler on the road, carrying presents to a Gompa. He gave us 2 rupees each, without our asking for money. We were naturally most astonished at this unexpected windfall. We did not always take our disguise as beggars very seriously. Once in the heart of Tibet, we preferred to save time by purchasing our supplies. Nevertheless, unsolicited alms came our way several times. Never in my life have I made so economical a journey. We used to laugh as we tramped along the road, recalling all the stories we had read of travelers who started out with many camels laden with heavy and expensive stores and luggage only to meet with failure more or less near their goal. I could have done the whole journey without any money in my pocket, but as we were extravagant beggars, indulging in molasses cakes, dried fruits, the best tea, and plenty of butter, we succeeded in spending 100 rupees in our 4 months' journey from Yunnan to Lhasa. One need not be rolling in riches to travel in the blessed lands of Asia. Chapter 4. I had been told at Tashitsi, to go to Poyul you can choose between 2 roads. One follows the valley, the other cuts through the hills. The first one crosses many villages and passes near several monasteries. Robbers are not much to be feared on that side. At the worst the traveler may meet some petty thieves, 3 or 4 men roaming together at night, who do not generally kill those whom they attack. It is also easy, on that road, to get food either by begging or by purchasing it. The second is a mountain track, and, although fairly good, it runs through a wilderness. Until the first villages of the Poyul are reached, you will tramp in a desert probably without meeting a single soul. And this is the best that can happen to you, for those you meet might be highwaymen from the Po country, coming and going on some looting expedition. They would certainly not trouble about the contents of your beggar's bags, but might possibly kill you, vexed to have been seen and anxious to avoid any further talk. You will also have to pass 2 very high passes, and a large tract of land between. Snow has not yet fallen heavily this year. You may succeed in crossing the range, but you must be ready to face the worst, for snow might close the road of the first pass, after your passage, so that, if you found the second closed also, you would be caught in a trap. If you risk the adventure, you must take a large supply of food with you. You may possibly meet a few Dokpas camped between the 2 ranges, but they will neither give nor sell any food. They have scarcely enough for themselves to last until next spring. I did not give much time to pondering over this news. The valley road was marked on all the maps, but that does not necessarily mean, where Tibet is concerned, that any foreigner has followed it. It often happens that the line marked on the map by the mapmaker is traced, not from his actual knowledge, but according to information received from natives, and Tibetans are rather vague, if not quite fanciful, in describing the roads and the country which they cross. Anyhow, the Rong Lamu in question was, I could well believe, rather well known by the Chinese. The other one, on the contrary, was unexplored. Maps ignored it completely, as well as the passes which it crossed. These passes were, no doubt, those at the foot of which sprang the River Po, referred to by the English general who, strange as it might appear, had a good deal of responsibility in the choice of my present itinerary. His name was Sir George Pereira. We often spoke of him, Yongdan and I, and we meant to relate to him our prowess on our return. We were far from thinking that he would die on a road of the Chinese Far East, about the time we entered that Poyul which we had looked at together on the map. General Pereira had arrived at Jakiendo when I had just returned there after a tour in that part of Kham that extends from the grassy desert to the southern trade road, Atpan, going from Kiamdo to Lhasa. That trip, during which I had gathered most interesting information, ended suddenly, a dollar I have dot related. I was stopped and prevented from proceeding southwards toward the Sailween. No doubt the general had learned this from the servants or other people, but, as I did not take him into my confidence as to my unpleasant adventure, he never alluded to it in our talks. He spent a fortnight in an apartment situated opposite to mine in the same courtyard, and we often met to take tea or to visit some place of interest. He was a well-bred, elderly gentleman, a charming scholar, a geographer, and a tireless globetrotter. He was suspected at Jakiendo of being charged with a secret mission by his government. Many things were rumored of which I cannot say whether they were true or not. It was a matter of indifference to me. General Pereira was on his way to Lhasa by the Northern Valley Road, trade route, and he openly spoke of it. Although a Danish traveler had been stopped but a few weeks before on that very same road, the general was certain that orders had been sent to the Tibetans to receive him with due regard, and thus it turned out. He carried with him a quantity of maps, and himself surveyed the country through which he went, working strenuously a part of the night to put his notes in order, and taking but little interest in the picturesque aspect of the customs, feasts, and the like of the country. Very kindly he put his maps and some of his notes at my disposal. I copied from them a number of useful points for the future journey I had already planned. Some of these rough map sketches have accompanied me to Lhasa, hidden in my boots, and, thanks to them, I have been able to verify on my way how incomplete the geographical knowledge of that part of the world still is. One afternoon, after having had tea together, we were speaking about Tibet. A map remained open on a table, and with the tip of his finger Sir George Pereira followed the thin line marking the supposed course of the Po. "Nobody has ever been there," he said. "There may be several accessible passes above the spring of the river. It would be an interesting way to Lhasa." Did he speak on purpose to give me a hint, or had his words no special meaning? I never knew. More than once I had considered the idea of crossing the Po country. It was an old idea of mine, for I had discussed it with Yongden 3 years before, in the Kambum Monastery, but the vague facts I had gathered about Po Yul from traders of central Tibet or the people of Kham had been rather discouraging. Many maintained that the Pepas were cannibals. Others, more moderate in their opinions, left this question unsettled. But all united in affirming that anyone foreign to the Po tribes, who entered their country, was never seen again. So I hesitated a little before risking this adventure, when the words of the general decided me. "Nobody has ever been there." All right. I would see these ranges and these passes. Truly it would be an interesting road to Lhasa. Hearty thanks to you, sir, who on purpose or by chance did me a real service. I was now at the foot of the hills about which I had dreamed for years. Hesitation was impossible. Tashitsi, where I chose the road which was to lead to so many adventures, is an important village situated in a wide valley near Azonga, built on an isolated hillock. Tashitsi means the prosperous summit, or the summit of prosperity. Both translations can be justified on the score of grammar, since the bottom of the valley does not in the least correspond to one's geographical notion of a summit. One is compelled to look to the other translation, which, alas, appears as inexact as the first one. The poor country folk of the region are, I have heard, far from having reached the height of prosperity. Taxes, statute labor, and a number of other ways of plundering them, which the villagers lament, fill the strong box of the Ponpo perched on his hillock, and it is very likely that it is to his paltry citadel we must look to find the prosperous summit. I reached the place rather early in the afternoon and had time to go round a begging, the purpose of which was to deceive the official or his men if they happened to hear about my presence. The poor peasants, to whom my apparent poverty and my beggarly attire gave confidence, described their distress in that country where the soil does not produce every year enough grain to pay the tax in kind. To leave the country, to look for better land or less exacting lords, is not permitted. A few ventured the flight and established themselves in neighboring provinces. Having been discovered, they were taken away from the new home they had created and led back to Tassitsi, where they were beaten and heavily fined.